Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Susan Shand and Alice Bryant. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Susan Shand.
Tens of millions of children are forced to work in countries around the world. The United Nations International Labour Organization called for an end to child labor Wednesday to mark World Day Against Child Labor. The Geneva, Switzerland-based ILO is holding its yearly International Labor Conference. Children as young as 5 are among the 152 million victims of child labor. Many of them work long hours for little or no money in slave-like conditions. The International Labor Organization says half of them are involved in unhealthy and dangerous work. The ILO says most children work in agriculture. They can also be found in the mining, building, fishing, and domestic service industries. Beata Andres is chief of the ILO's Fundamental Principles and Rights at Work branch. She told VOA that when children are forced into the worst forms of labor, such as debt slavery and sex work, they suffer permanent physical and mental damage. Andres said some progress has been made in reducing child labor in Asia and Latin America, but reductions in Africa are decreasing. She said Africa now has the highest levels of child labor in the world. This is not necessarily linked to a lack of action, Andres said, explaining that migration, poverty, and other problems can lead to child labor. Andres said she was pleased to see the African Union taking decisive measures to end child labor. She noted the AU is developing a 10-year plan to decrease child labor, as called for in the UN's Sustainable Development Goals. The SDG has called for the end of child labor by 2025. However, at the current level of reduction, Andres warns the world will easily miss that goal. I'm Susan Shand.
Vatican Radio, the official broadcasting service of the Roman Catholic Church, recently began its first regular news broadcast in Latin.
Franciscus daco Romaniam invisit tres dies ut parvula cum ecclesia ambulet.
The program is called Hebdomada Pape Notitiae Vaticanae Latinae Radiate. In English, that means The Pope's Week. Vatican News in the Latin language. The broadcast is the latest effort to expand the use of Latin, the language of all Roman Catholic religious services. Latin was once an important part of Western European education. The weekly Vatican radio broadcast lasts 5 minutes. It will be followed by a 30-minute show with Latin conversation. Andrea Tornielli is the lead director for Vatican Communications. He said, "We wanted the official language of the Church to be experienced in news just as it is in the daily broadcast of a Mass in Latin." The radio's news team, as well as the Vatican's Latin Translation Department, will produce the program. Italian businessman Luca Desiata published a new book of crossword puzzles in Latin and Ancient Greek this month. The publication is thought to be the first with no help or definitions in modern languages. Desiata said the internet has helped renew interest in Latin as more and more schools around the world stop teaching it. He told Reuters, "We now have Wikipedia in Latin, about 40 Latin Facebook groups around the world, and the Pope's Twitter account in Latin is followed by nearly 1 million people. Not bad for a dead language." In 2012, Pope Benedict XVI started the Pontifical Academy for Latin Studies to promote the use of Latin in the Church and elsewhere. Many attempts have been made to bring Latin back to popular use. Some have tried to introduce new words for things that did not exist at the time of the Roman Empire. However, not all of them have caught on. In the 1990s, for example, top Vatican Latin researcher Father Carlo Egger came up with some words for common objects in the home. For example, he came up with machina lintiorum lavatoria for a washing machine. He also created escariorum lavator for dishwasher and autocinatorum lavatrix for car wash.
Have you ever had someone repair a home appliance, but it kept breaking? I have been having trouble with my sink for a month. Yesterday, the maintenance man repaired it again, and it worked fine. Once. But then, last night, I turned the water on low and walked away for just a few seconds. When I returned, I noticed water all over the floor. I was about to go to bed, but instead I had to clean up the mess. Ugh, the sink keeps leaking. So in a little while, I'll go ask the building supervisor to replace it. I just use 3 conversational English forms in my sad sink story. All are common to American English, and some are common to other Englishes. They involve the words about, keep, and go. On today's program, I will talk about them. And I am about to begin. English speakers use the form be about to emphasize that an action will happen very soon. It is a friendly form we use in speech every day. For example, I told you I was about to go to bed. That means I was at the point of starting that action. We can also use be about to for such subjects as things and ideas. We can say, for example, it's about to rain, and the proposal is about to be released. The sentence structure is the verb be plus about to plus base verb. The base form of a verb is its shortest form with no S ending. Listen to a quick exchange between friends hurrying to an event.
Hi, Jonathan.
Hey, Sue. Have you left the house yet?
No, but I was just about to put on my shoes.
Perfect. I'm about to hop on the metro. See you in a few.
Sue said, "I was just about to put on my shoes." Note her use of the past tense, was. We can use be about to with the present or past tense of the verb be. Note also that the word just is common with this form. If people say they are just about to do something, it means they expect to do it right now. The negative form of be about to has a completely different meaning, however. It means someone feels a strong desire or willpower to do something. For instance, I'm not about to miss this show. I paid $70 for the ticket. It's like saying I will go to the show and won't let anyone or anything stop me. The negative is not always considered friendly, so use it carefully. Now let's move to the verb keep plus a gerund, which is the ing form of a verb. When we use this form, it means that something is happening continuously or again and again. Earlier, you heard me say, the sink keeps leaking. The verb keep is followed by the gerund leaking. We often use keep plus gerund to show irritation that an action or situation has not stopped. We also sometimes use it with the preposition on. Students keep playing with their mobile phones in class, for example. The cat keeps on scratching the chairs. And my teammate keeps hitting the ball too far. Other times, we use it to give directions or tell someone how to do something. Listen to this person give a friend directions to her house and tell them what to do when they arrive.
Keep walking straight until you see a flower shop on the right. My house is the first building behind the shop. Dinner preparations are on the table. When you boil the noodles, please keep stirring them. Otherwise, they'll stick together. Thanks.
You heard the speaker say, keep walking straight, to tell them to continue walking. They also said, please keep stirring the noodles to make sure the friend does this continuously. And finally, we have the form go, come plus verb. In spoken English, we often add the verb go or come to other action verbs. When we do this, we are talking about an action in the future. I said, for example, so tomorrow I'll go ask the building supervisor to replace it. The structure is go, come, plus base verb. I used the base verb ask. Use of go and come do not change the meaning of what we're saying. Instead, they make our speech sound friendlier and more natural. Listen to how our speaker uses the verbs come and go here.
Come visit me in July. You can stay for the long weekend. There's a huge film festival happening, so we can go see a lot of movies in a short time.
The speaker's use of come in come visit me in July, for instance, sounds more natural in everyday speech than visit me in July. Another version of this form adds the word and. An example would be, come and visit me in July. The and is common to British and other Englishes, but only in some parts of the United States. Well, that's all for today. Go listen for these forms wherever you hear English being spoken. Then, come tell us what you find. I'm about to sign off and go find the building supervisor. See you soon. I'm Alice Bryant.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Today we tell about the period known as the Cold War. The Cold War began after World War II. The main enemies were the United States and the Soviet Union. The Cold War got its name because both sides were afraid of fighting each other directly. In a hot war, nuclear weapons might destroy everything. So instead, both sides fought each other indirectly. They supported opposing sides in conflicts in different parts of the world. They also used words as weapons. They threatened and denounced each other, or they tried to make each other look foolish. Over the years, leaders on both sides changed, yet the Cold War continued. It was the major force in world politics for most of the second half of the 20th century. The Cold War world was separated into three groups. The United States led the West. This group included countries with democratic political systems. The Soviet Union led the East. This group included countries with communist political systems. The non-aligned group included countries that did not want to be tied to either the West or the East. Harry Truman was the first American president to fight the Cold War. He used several policies. One was the Truman Doctrine. This was a plan to give money and military aid to countries threatened by communism. The Truman Doctrine effectively stopped communists from taking control of Greece and Turkey. Another policy was the Marshall Plan. This strengthened the economies and governments of countries in Western Europe. A major event in the Cold War was the Berlin Airlift. After World War II, the United States and its allies divided Germany. Berlin was a part of communist East Germany. The city was divided into East and West. In June 1948, Soviet-led forces blocked all roads and railways leading to the western part of Berlin. President Truman quickly ordered military airplanes to fly coal, food, and medicine to the city. The planes kept coming, sometimes landing every few minutes for more than a year. The United States received help from Britain and France. Together, they provided almost 2.5 million tons of supplies on about 280,000 flights. The United States also led the formation of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization in 1949. NATO was a joint military group. Its purpose was to defend against Soviet forces in Europe. The Soviet Union and its East European allies formed their own joint military group, the Warsaw Pact, 6 years later. In 1953, Soviet leader Joseph Stalin died. His death gave the new American president Dwight Eisenhower a chance to deal with new Soviet leaders. In July 1955, Eisenhower and Nikolai Bulganin met in Geneva, Switzerland. The leaders of Britain and France also attended. Eisenhower proposed that the Americans and Soviets agree to let their military bases be inspected by air by the other side. The Soviets later rejected the proposal. Yet, the meeting in Geneva was not considered a failure. After all, the leaders of the world's most powerful nations had shaken hands. Cold War tensions increased, then eased, then increased again over the years. The changes came as both sides attempted to influence political and economic developments around the world. For example, the Soviet Union provided military, economic, and technical aid to communist governments in Asia. The United States then helped 8 Asian nations fight communism by establishing the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, known as CETO. In the 1950s, the United States began sending military advisors to help South Vietnam defend itself against communist North Vietnam. That aid would later expand into a long and bloody period of American involvement in Vietnam. The Cold War also affected the Middle East. In the 1950s, both East and West offered aid to Egypt to build the Aswan High Dam on the Nile River. The West canceled its offer, however, after Egypt bought weapons from the communist government in Czechoslovakia. Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser then seized control of the company that operated the Suez Canal. A few months later, Israel invaded Egypt. France and Britain joined the invasion. For once, the United States and the Soviet Union agreed on a major issue. Both supported a United Nations resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire. The Suez Crisis was a political victory for the Soviets. When the Soviet Union supported Egypt, it gained new friends in the Arab world. In 1959, Cold War tensions eased a little. The new Soviet leader, Nikita Khrushchev, visited Dwight Eisenhower in the United States. The meeting was very friendly. But the next year, relations got worse again. An American U-2 reconnaissance airplane was shot down over the Soviet Union. The plane and its pilot, Francis Gary Powers, were captured. Eisenhower admitted that such planes had been spying on the Soviets for years. In a speech at the United Nations, Khrushchev got so angry that he took off his shoe and beat it on a table. John F. Kennedy followed Eisenhower as president in 1961. During his early days in office, Cuban exiles invaded Cuba. It came to be known as the Bay of Pigs invasion. The forces wanted to oust the communist government of Fidel Castro. America's Central Intelligence Agency had provided training for the exiles. But the United States failed to send military planes to protect them during the invasion. As a result, almost all were killed or taken prisoner by Cuban forces trained and supported by the Soviet Union and Soviet allied nations. At the same time in Europe, tens of thousands of East Germans had been fleeing to the West. East Germany's government decided to stop them. It built a wall separating the eastern and western parts of the city of Berlin. Guards shot at anyone who tried to flee by climbing over. During Kennedy's second year in office, American intelligence reports discovered Soviet missiles in Cuba.
This government, as promised, has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba. Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere.
The Soviet Union denied the missiles were there. Yet American photographs taken from high in the air proved they were. America's ambassador to the United Nations, Adlai Stevenson.
Let me ask you one simple question. Do you, Ambassador Zorin, deny that the USSR has placed and is placing medium and intermediate range missiles and sites in Cuba? Yes or no? Don't wait for the translation, yes or no?
Mr. Stevenson, would you continue your statement, please? You will receive the answer in the due course. Do not worry.
I'm prepared to wait for my answer until hell freezes over, if that's your decision. And I'm also prepared to present the evidence in this room.
The Cuban Missile Crisis easily could have resulted in a nuclear war. Americans felt especially threatened with those missiles just 150 kilometers from the Florida coast. But the crisis ended after a week. Khrushchev agreed to remove the missiles if the United States agreed not to interfere in Cuba. Some progress was made in easing Cold War tensions when Kennedy was president. In 1963, the two sides reached a major arms control agreement. They agreed to ban tests of nuclear weapons above ground, underwater, and in space. They also established a direct telephone link between the White House and the Kremlin. Relations between East and West also improved when Richard Nixon was president. He and Leonid Brezhnev met several times. They reached several arms control agreements. One reduced the number of missiles used to shoot down enemy nuclear weapons. It also banned the testing and deployment of long-distance missiles for 5 years. A major change in the Cold War would take place in 1985 when Mikhail Gorbachev became leader of the Soviet Union. He met four times with President Ronald Reagan. Gorbachev withdrew Soviet forces from Afghanistan, and he signed an agreement with the United States to destroy all middle-distance and short-distance nuclear missiles. By 1989, there was widespread unrest in Eastern Europe. Gorbachev did not intervene as one Eastern European country after another cut its ties with the Soviet Union. The Berlin Wall, the major symbol of communist oppression, was torn down in November of that year. In less than a year, East and West Germany became one nation again. A few months after that, Warsaw Pact countries officially ended the alliance. The Cold War was over.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.